everyone.
Hi.
Hey, welcome to Three Friends Coffee House and to Three Friends Mondays. This is a weekly series we do, sometimes sporadically, sometimes weekly. It's been going on for 6 years. And the format is that three creative friends put on a show. If you're interested in learning more about that or submission process, it's very simple. You just basically send me an email and let me know what you have in mind. So I'm going to do some quick housekeeping, and then we're going to get the show started. Thank you to Three Friends Coffee House for letting us use this as a creative space. Yeah. And to the owner, Bobby. Yay. Oh. Okay. Thank you to the barista who I just met and whose name I forgot.
Kelsey.
Thank you, Kelsey. She does accept tips. All right. And then finally to my my cohorts who are part of Show and Tell Gallery. We're a team. We're all volunteers. We're all creative people. I want to thank Mary Slocum, Patrick Bocard, Nathan Reynolds, Joel Wegman, David De Serrano, and Rio Hibbler-Kerr. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do a weekly event, and I really appreciate all that contribute. And Mary's going to be running the open mic tonight. So thank you all. Okay. So tonight's performers are James Graybill, Matt Schumacher, and Dan Raphael. And Dan is going to do the honors of introducing everybody. And then at 8 o'clock, we'll stop and we'll take like a 15-minute break, get the open mic sign out so that you can sign up if you want to stay for that. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Well, you privileged few who are here to have the sweltering heat released with blazing cool linguistic energy. I salute you to those who are about to ecstasticize. We'll start out with a man who needs no introduction because he already was, and that's me. And then we'll have Matt and Jim. Kind of the spur for this reading was James's new book. Jim, hold up the book. Okay. It's Jim's first book in 8 years, but we'll get to more of that later. And let me just get back to a glass of water and I'll read you some quotes. I'm personally happy to be here because this is my first reading in Portland for the year of 2014, which is kind of unusual for me, but you flow with the go as it does. So,
and you're retired now, right?
Pretty much new poems. No, I'm not. I'm working part-time. Oh. I'm retired and, you know. And I think two of these poems have some inspiration from Jim, and that was just coincidence. No soup. There's no soup like dead soup, aged soup, soup buried in the yard and working its way back to the kitchen. Soup you can't resist, alphabet soup with over 30 letters. Courage soup, soup flavored only with things you've never tasted. Soup in a shot glass, in an aquarium, in the middle of a double pane window, ant colony drowned in soup. Soup frozen in ripples like corduroy, silky, woolly. Soup without anything natural. Used soup, vintage soup. A different soup for every room in the house. Soup mosquitoes hate. A soup only my grandmother could make. Revolving door soup, loud as a helicopter soup. When I slurp, it sounds like snapping a shotgun. Eating soup with chopsticks. Using only bread, a glass straw, pressing my face in the cool enough soup. This soup is slow motion, cubistic animation. Everything machined into pinhead-sized pieces. And the glass bowl is a snow globe, telling my future, answering my questions. Every spoonful, another day. There's a Buddhist concept I'm not quite clear of. I think it's called like bodhicitta, which is like the the loving compassion, but to me it looked like Body City. And Body City Bodhisattva. I won't leave till everyone's living in the appropriate place. House body nestled in earth, spring tree skies, bird constellations, link and swoop, decorating rooftops with animated calligraphy, waiting for the ink to separate into letters, waiting for instructions to sprout across my screen. If everyone went to bed when I did, the Earth's orbit would be threatened. The way tomatoes change a soup's color, the way skin facilitates music, like taking 5 minutes to rub one palm across the other and spending hours decompressing what I heard, graphing how the volumes peak and wane, like a huge what the fuck, traversing the sky, changing echoes and overtones. As learning a new song each day soon requires changes in wardrobe, paycheck, and friends. We're no longer the same modality. So few settle, and now that music's no longer local, every past is available today. Every style's contemporary. Songs so new, you start dancing before you hear them. When the whole city's dancing, I will rest. Oh, it's called a Luna moth, but the ones with the like big black spots on them, and there was one kind of setting up to die in our garden. It was like about this big. And it was, if a wing. If there's a wing in my mouth, boneless but tendoned, Teflon feathers cool in evaporating sauce, body cigar, thumb body opening in the middle like a gondola without the blimp, like living in a B-52, shedding metallic skin for windows and solar. The weight of chemistry in leaves, in rivers layered like batteries, photothetic lasagna bubbling with energy unable to cohere as what's below keeps reacting with its neighbors. I move to the wilderness and give all the trees names and personalities. Hours on our wireless intercom. The squirrels are books, the raccoons are movies, each bird's a window I could teleport through. Then a past adventure shows up, fragrant and savory. So many vines to launch myself with alternate arms, gravity plus mass factoring wind, surface to air, will to distance, breathing with everything but my lungs, they're my wings now. The topography I'm trying to fly toward, replacing skin with maps that bulge from veins and tendons. With wings, no arms, so clever feet. Mouth with multiple grips, belly like a table, mouth like a demolition crew. Only the paranoid need camouflage. My thoughts have wings, rippling a patch of aerial density, swallows so muscular you can stretch one into a bowstring. What I thought, a mural are thousands of butterflies hanging where trees used to breathe, certain breakfast on its way. This is one of those poems, you know, how poets do these things with poems in multiple pieces. So, moments from the history of rain. Rain wasn't always like it is now. Instead of falling, it came from a hidden dimension, bringing wet the soil would welcome, wet would try to collect in shape. It means it's a different part. Once rain swarmed like bees, inundating fields or selectively touching only blue collars, only animals with stubby tails. Hurricanes and tornadoes were rituals where the queen filled the sky with unexplainable presence. Air so rich with oxygen, the rain became acidic, turning giant ferns to mush, eating away dinosaur skins to polish their bones. when the moon couldn't yet pull the oceans, but focused the moisture exchange, creating deficits and surpluses, hoping the right amount in the right place would distract gravity. Wind was meteor then, thumbing, strumming lunar strings, drinking lustily yet never letting go. A river spewing its own tail, when during summer water got so thick and redolent, we cultivated plants that hid the smells. Silence, what we couldn't decide were myth, history, or infomercials. Noah's reign was 40 days and nights of drop-shaped vessels evacuating Earth, darkening the skies with all the buildings and records they destroyed. What we thought were volcanoes were camouflaged incinerators. When I come back, rain's at its best, unpredictable, generous, and nourishing. We still have roofs and slickers to keep from overdosing. Indoors, we're naked out of reverence, deeply joyed when our cupped hands fill with rain from elsewhere. This one was written on June 21st. More solstice, less equinox. When I puked out, the biochemistry from my previous planet began to manifest, incompatible with the world where the air isn't half chlorine and mercury's not essential to all life. Here, every step is a struggle habituated into personal finances. Shoes were created by the first chiropractors. The unhatted are devious or mildly suicidal. Once my dreams are played out, I put the fuel nozzle to my navel and let orchestras of puffy chemistry burrow into the soil beneath my skin. Personal grooming, intestinal weave, everything I eat has its own locomotion and compass. For almost a year, I never saw the moon and forgot it existed. In my solar system, most of the planets are sheathed in robes of debris, and only Earth and Wittgenstein have clearly defined orbits, vast interstellar freeways with more toll booths than off-ramps. That day after my 11th birthday, I was flipping pages of three-dimensional topology and knew where I would adult, what tattoos I would need, how the sun at noon could wipe me out with ravenous imagery, insatiable demands, recipes with zero margin of error. Slowly, architecture loses its influence, and we go back to imitating trees without realizing the puppetry staged by squirrels and sparrows. As the leaves turn to brittle crystals, the air packs its bags and fills every available bus, train, and helicopter. In the increasing vacuum, undeveloped fields bulge with the promise of new barriers, and tendrils will have to learn to skin, salt, and broil when we find the key to the freezer. When the census taker arrives with our improved barcodes, when the week's cloud cover reveals its oval shape and cracks open, revealing the double-yoked sun. By next week, the foothills will be flowered and toasted, the orchards abuzz with fermentation. I'll close with this one. My wife came across this like art photography collector's magazine, and this Chinese woman had taken a series of pictures for the 12 zodiac signs, and the babies are huge and naked and have the sign Photoshop tattooed on their bodies, and mom sitting against a strange city background, and it just kind of freaked me out. One moon, one baby. Baby's too big in the moon, with mom tattooing skin time in ancient script to identify, indemnify against the transposed background of architecture, archaeologizing vases we can't make yet. teeth biting through wire with persistent questions, as charging arguments extol the raisin rain, extra virgin rain. Rain we don't want talking to the car, ready to find a road like caramel anchovies stirred in milk without animal origin. Milk from magazines, milk from hoofless mountains. An oaken chest, not my chest, not drawers but pigeonholes switching places. A mechanized 3D chessboard without kings and bishops, with botanists, lawyers, and DJs. We don't know how the pieces move. When the board unfolds, GPS for gypsies, where motorhomes, solar winds turn a field into a market. Market intelligence, market humor. I subscribe with a genome. The interest is mutation. We'll be out of bread tomorrow when the bakery's on sabbatical. When the day doesn't change just because of night, when nothing closes. We sleep in our workplaces, careful not to drift onto conveyors, into robot tentacles, suggesting three elbows per limb. Spherical wrists so I can write on my own hand, piercing the flesh with solder, so bright and promising. Give us this day our daily voltage. Resistance defines character. I won't leap till I can glide. Ask the moon questions and watch its eyes. Lost like craters. Dust instead of tears escapes before evaporating all the structural members beneath the eons of paint, detritus, almosts, and maybes. The technology to take a picture in the same place once a month for 1,000 years. Incompatible with our viewers, rampant compression, pixelations, something fresh for breakfast with the wings too milk damp to more than buzz and shimmer. Maps drawn on sand with memory and attitude, deepening dents where depressions flourish, the challenge of vertical. Coffee like magma, soil receiving seeds, encrypting their own tails as the sun chases its offspring moon, enwrapped with long-leashed freedom, breaking away the bucket we were saving to shower when the sun gets so naked even our bones begin to sweat. We couldn't touch ourselves. Hands slipping through, fingers like ripe fruit, the flies volunteer to flesh us. The mosquitoes ready to change our fluids and vacuum our interiors for $19.99. Who would want a baby they couldn't name? A baby we had to change countries to live with, have a tongue transplant to learn the language programmed in the baby's third eye. Baby running before it could hold a fork, refusing to wear any color but black, only drinking when underwater. Baby who won't sleep when the moon's above, no matter how intense the cloud cover or daylight. How deep we bury the baby in concentric libraries. As the whole village tells their stories, the baby transcribes in concentric and overcooked cereal, transforming the torrent of post-industrial formula into sculptural gardens we run through, ecstatically shedding our skins with the multi-barbed stamens of the baby's galactic tear down and remodel. If you lived in this baby, you'd be where now? Behind the wheel of this one-owner baby still under warranty, Stevie singing, maybe your baby's done made some other plans. The moon staying full just to see who'll show up. Electrician, demolition, bill collector, midwife. Moon shunting all the sun throws to ignite its own cherry center and release this adolescent star, massaging the earth with ripe gravitic heat. Thank you. And speaking of heat, we have Matt Schumacher moving it that way. I mean, he's a man, you know, I know more about his myth than his actual person. I mean, is it the second or third PhD you're working on, Matt? Only the second one? Okay, all right. You know, he teaches in 5 colleges at once and often classes at the same time. But But he's not here for that. He's there for his excellent poetry. Again, bright colors, wild language. That's why we're here. Matt Schumann.
Really great to be here. With reading with two poets I like so much, Jim and Dan. So thanks for having me. This poem's for one of my best friends. It's called Dear Sulcata Tortoise. When we pulled over suddenly and I sprinted to save you before you crossed the busy highway, then brought you home in the back of our van, I had no idea you were destined to attain a greater weight than mine and to outlive me. I didn't know I could fall in love with a bulldozer, a sub-Saharan African eating machine. I didn't know the tortoise eye could mystify, staring straight from the Cretaceous, that your war helmet would ceaselessly patrol the yard on stubby legs, part dinosaur, part toddler, ready to do combat in your shield, carapace encasing your back legs like a diaper. I didn't know the other pets would get out of your way, as if they knew you would one day outgrow them. I had no idea it could be so positively hypnotic to assist you as you gorge yourself on arugula and pumpkin, to watch you luncheon on tufts of dandelion and clover, to see you look up at us with a face like a child's drawing, flapping your flipper-like arms and frustrated, or sighing gently when asleep, just like a human being. This poem's called In Praise of Somersaulting Spiders. If you go look on YouTube, you can look the species up. It's indigenous to Morocco, and it somersaults down sand dunes to escape from predators, that sort of thing. So I tried to write in terse rima for the first time in my life. In Praise of Somersaulting Spiders. I admire Sibrenus reckenbergi, the desert spider, somersaulting arachnid, flick-flack king of Moroccan sand dune acrobatics. As if lighter, when tumbling, it doubles its speed. Its act brings black and white Wright Brothers flights to mind. A tumbleweed with legs, it flings itself to life. The fluffy stuff of cotyledon seed, light beyond belief, mere handful of a dream. There's also something of a lonely glove blown down the street on bright blustery days, or maybe Plato's archetypal beings who, when split apart, created longing we call love. Then I find that if it hurls itself end over end for too long, fleeing from human or scorpion one too many times, the spider dies. And it's impossible not to note some universal essence in this motion, this head over heels sequence. Here lies that part of us content to relinquish all common sense, all control, and shove ourselves over mountainsides. The idea calls to mind hang gliders circling off cliff's edges when sighted on alpine summits, unsure thermals buffeting their rides. We're reckless like this, breaking our branch off the tree, risking everything we have for stupid pride, or for some nameless momentary thrill, swirling in the avalanche of chance. We're gambling tangle-legged things in mid-spin, dervishes given to the winds, anesthetized by chaos's dance, desperate to never be the same again. Thanks so much. So I've been working on these fantastical drinking songs. Yeah, featuring the exploits of a group of picaresque heroes known as the Miraculous Alcoholics. This is a backward epicedarius, presumably what they would tell the police when the alcoholics, when stopped and asked to recite the alphabet backwards. It's called Miraculous Backward Epicedarius Recited for Police. Zeroing in on the ouzo, these yeast-soused roustabouts whose labors avail our revelry, X'd out of their minds on boxed wine, like wharf rats stowed inside puncheons of rum, vermouth to the tooth, urinating on no trespassing signs, tremble mont déterred, surrender to rapidly shifting mood. Raiders blackstrapped, quizzically liquored to the boots, picaresque drinkers jousting with windowsills, oscillating on bar stools, compasses used to navigate to weave whiskied streams, malted crusaders lapping rapturously croizen beers, jubilantly infused with inebriance, they hector slime and ooze into nectar. Such guzzlers grow flabbergasted on dubious punch, ecstatic as if lightning were their sombrero, dram slamming curanderos, brandish as many arms as an octopus, and tip up a drink in each one. Thanks so much. This is another drinking song. It's called Incomprehensibly Thirsty. Sires of full pints flirt with frightful splurge, only to lure servers into the absurd, like Caspar Hauser's half-wild wolf-child howlers, doused mouths won't pronounce a word. Spilling hard sarsaparilla, befuddled sluggards, chug sud, slur and curse, barbaric Martian bars, mar mahogany bars, like loose toothful alligator gar. Stun gun lushes like drunk bums, slog through froth and mash, flushed and mum, drink dash and slash all slush funds. Charlatans clearly chant when out of earshot. Smashing wits to bits can be such roguish fun. When mush-mouthed gushers stumble into dumps and slap the bar for more, like humpback whales' thunderclaps assail cold Atlantic waters, fearful barmen rush to satisfy their wants. Just one more of those. They liquefy their lives. The alcoholics liquefying their lives. Liquidate our fates in triplicate, carousers shout, when the miraculous alcoholics high hurdle open bars, confiscating whiskey jars and pints of stout. Diving into deep ends, they thieve the very sheen, the little stars of alcoholic liquids gleam, infuse their threads with fluid, lustrous stuff. Leave fortune's wheels slickly bewitched, sneaking up on the three fates with super soakers loaded with tequila. Spindles slide and drip with liquid lives. We must be fluid, shifting streams, not dry, finite threads, they cry, firing away. To deal all the tarot cards, resend their end, to shine so bright they can't be switched by dimmers. Grabbing at the tap and racks behind the bar, with the bubble-bursting breaststroke of failed beginner swimmers, like flailing fools suckled by Charybdises, lubricated pale ghouls float to bar stools, fists filled to refulgence with top-shelf gin. Gleeful as midshipmen on shore leave, as Odysseus is ready to begin again in Ithaca, as inmates just let go, they barge right into maelstroms a spin. Oh, tilt a whirling water holes where our heroes give sobriety the old heave ho. I'll just do a couple from my books. Spilling the Moon is my first book. I'll read a little something called The Cruelty of Foosball.
And it's got a fantastic cover.
Yeah, Jessica Plattner, who's now lives in Alberta. Yeah, she was an Eastern Oregonian for a while, but The Cruelty of Foosball. The real losers of foosball must be its small athletes. Imagine being one of them, shish kebabbed in rigid position, in tight-fitting generic uniform, while some drunk foosball enthusiast's misguided instinct or whim spins you upside down in a nightmare jungle gym. Trapped in your little foosball reality, without significant features painted on your face and a hair helmet molded on your head, your reflexes and athleticism shackled to a lackadaisical armchair soccer star's demands, your glide entirely dependent on a grabbing hand. Gored on the glory of an illegitimate ball field at random in ill-lit basements, you'd endure the torture of advancing only sideways and never ahead. I'll close out with a couple couple of poems from the second book, The Fire Diaries, and wanted to read some poems in the voice of fire in here, actual fires, and some poems that are just, well, like this one, actually. This is August 7th, 1948. This one's just sort of more about the historical event, kind of strange fire in the middle of Illinois. And did some research on it. August 7th, 1948. The faceless gods of burning barns and rural fires claim their own sacrifices. A host of unexplained blazes engulf the Willey Farm in Macomb, Illinois. 200 fires a week, 29 a day. So fantastic, I'm ashamed, admits the town fire chief in disbelief. The Illinois fire marshal agrees. No one, swears he, has seen mania take flame like this before. According to the Air Force, it's directed Russian radiation. Brown spots smolder like bad radar on the wallpaper, scaring neighbors who stand by with hoses ready for impending conflagration. Hordes of reporters and exorcists fail to sort through or dissuade the growing yellow-orange outrage. Blamed for the enraged drapes, for the white-hot milk house, a board-troubled team named Juanette McNeil, forced to live with her uncle after a divorce, tries to escape by burning down the place. Jailed for petty mischief, she assailed every crease of acreage with hate, with limitless struck kitchen matches. They say her fervor lit fireproof plaster, seethed across wet floor and ceiling. Dissenters, however, assert invisible causes, pyro poltergeists insatiable for flame, teenage psychokinesis. Thanks so much. Okay, so just one more. I've got a group of characters. I guess if you were researching a fire, as they do these days with forensic research and such, these would be the unsolvable fires. These would be the sorts of spirits that would be responsible if you could never solve them. These guys close out the book. I call them the fire spirits. And so this poem is one of those poems. Where fire spirits reside, it's called. They retire like a nightmare roosting on the eyelid. They crash out at the home address of madness. Their spray-painted house number stays illegibly ablaze. Only black smoke escapes their nomadic abode, that cracked-out fraction of a halfway house. These estranged and homeless ghosts are stoked to stay at your place. Behold their fistfuls of lit matches and stash gas cans, the roots of fuses that protrude from under stair and door. They're sold on smoldering metamorphosis. For every burning house forms multifarious houses. They like that the right flick of butane can unglue a duplex. They like their bungalows swallowed to the rafter, their cabins hissing kiosks of flame. They like their glass of shambles with a side of crumbling cinder as they twist, shift, and vary char and singe. Silos explode, red doorknobs bewilder in dream houses of ember. Hell's seven circles are their hula hoops. The fire spirits binge on scarlet laughter, gasp at the opportunity to ruin everything before firemen storm front doors. They see our past reality deteriorate up close while we gaze at it in disbelief across the street. Inside, they worm themselves, grow cozy on the glowing ironwork, on spiral staircases we never knew existed. They place their melting family photos on the mantle. They bask, reclining on bright tin ceilings, their diluted blue-green eyes change color with the fire, unseen as the deep sea and staring through our world. Thank you.
Dare I say the matchless Matt Schumacher.
Yeah, and it's just purely coincidence that Matt's two books, Jim's newest book, and a couple of my past ones all come from Wordcraft of Oregon from David Mehmet. You think it's a coincidence, but it just shows that there aren't too many publishers willing to publish really creative, visionary poems like this. And another example coming up with Jim Grable, who's I've known a long time. He's one of my best friends. So I'm not really objective in any way. Reading his last book, I almost thought I'd just burn all my poems because there's no sense in doing any more. But of course, burning poems is, you know, puts carbon in the air, and we don't want to do any of that. So besides being a poet, Jim has been teaching and researching on sustainability for several years, and that has informed his poems as his passion for language meets his passion for the planet, and wanting to figure things out. James Grable.
Thanks, Doc. Two great readings, I thought. Anglo-Saxon tradition. it's great to share, you know, the first part of the events here with Dan and Matt, and to just point to Wordcraft. David Mehmet lives in Le Grand, and you know, has been an energy-charged publisher of work. He wrote me when, you know, when we decided to do this book, he wrote me asking for a quick summary of, you know, what the book was about. And so I tried that a few times. And here's today's version. The problem with diving into study of a few details of current scientific findings and projections that pertain to global life support systems that we depend on as one of the number of organic species cells have created over eons. It seems to me is that it becomes necessary to take stock of the more habitual assumptions. Yeah. Great. Let's see. Did you get that so far?
I assume so.
Okay. So as one of the number of organic species cells have created over eons, the problem is that it becomes necessary to take stock of the more habitual assumptions we might have and to make a sincere effort to update the ways we live and how we are actually seeing the world. Well, that seems to be what this era might be about. You know, when people talk about the shift in paradigm, and so I've tried to use this book as a kind of a way into thinking about that. This is called A Civilized Story. Civilization overshoots its capacity. The more people, the hungrier everyone is. Celsius spikes, 100-year storms, flood, and so on. Rock and sun collide in the presence of water. The first single cells grow into animals. Some survive. Transcontinental asphalt heads off to intervene with zoological displays, centers of population, CO2 sequestrating plants, and so on. Fossil aquifers are being tapped. Dust and modern crop yields promote production of all the more people. Half the world attends the banquet, half gathers matter for bone soup. Grasshoppers descend on the dust bowl forever. Polar ice melts under assumptions lingering from earlier centuries. The story looks for its exceptionalism, reaching amino acids, the faster time moves, and so on. The more people afloat, the rockier sea level lifts. Beautiful and strange, dark scarlet veins of the large grasshoppers disappear. Brazilian rainforest canopies drag out their disappearance in front of razor-lit melts of hell yes and heavens no. And I know these are actually, you know, probably not, I mean, if you don't feel clapping, feel free to conserve energy. Here's a dream of hippos. One morning I woke from a dream where prickly hedges around a parking lot became the heads of hippos with ravenous appetites for the heads of people. These hippos could jump a person, chomp off the head, and then root back into the hedges. Soon, 9/11 had been called as we stepped out toward our cars. All the green thickness circling the lot, the hippos' fierce hungers eyeing us. At my feet was a headless human we dragged back into the room. Later, another day, I learned hippos were just determined endangered. The safest place to be when they were outside was the fundraising dinner, where everyone pretended to be characters from history. The Jay watched from a tall fir. That was a dream I had. I tried to write it down. No one lives alone. Because the past and future leave little room for the present, money can end up spending its people on a few thrills in Monaco, hypnotized by the roar from the empty stadium. Autonomous money in the present can be looking from a car window at medieval man. But then, not many who've opened a slow front door could take a next step without carrying along everyone who had a hand in making the door. Without walking into the wind with everyone they have known or descended from. Because ignorance has been so damn hungry for what it doesn't know, it follows what might pop up, going where anger leads, barking up a nearby tree, fighting a next war as if it were the last. Lonely and unnatural reasons must exist when possible pasts and futures that envelop the present are mailing it out instantaneously to request donations to preserved waterways or charismatic animals to assist the impoverished or underfunded public education as the present ice face slips faster into the sea. I'm teaching sustainability, life support systems, requires laying the groundwork, you know, of factual science, scientific findings as being the key. And anyway, this is a poem that comes from Scientific American. Sometimes when you read through it, there are details and little stories summaries of research that are really striking. But anyway, this is kind of a found poem in my language, but they're info. The New York Times headquarters, retrofit with floor-to-ceiling windows, sensor-linked internal lighting, has lowered energy costs by a quarter. The savings for each of its 26 or so floors has been approximately $13,000 a year. The renovation was paid for in savings over 3 years. A study published in the Archives of Dermatology described the usefulness of maggots, the removal of infected skin and dead tissue. Surgical debridement currently requires scissors, a scalpel, and quite a bit of time. Surgeons in France have found maggots are quicker and more precise. Researchers in the Netherlands have determined the secretions of maggots help clear infections. 2 dozen or so lesser galaxies orbit the Milky Way, which has absorbed the gas they'd use to make more stars, fortunately. Only two of the satellite galaxies, the large and small Magellanic Clouds, have the brilliance of young galaxies. New data through the Hubble has revealed that their immense orbit takes at least 4 billion years to complete and helps them remain intact. Swedish and South African researchers noticed that on clear nights without moonlight, ball rolling dung beetles travel in straight lines home. In a test, a group of dung beetles was released, a third fit with cardboard caps blocking their view of the sky, a third with transparent visors, and the final third bareheaded. Beetles able to see the stars took largely direct routes, whereas dung beetles wearing cardboard caps wandered. After ruling out alternatives, the study concluded that, left to their own devices, these beetles use the band of bright light that represents the Milky Way to determine their direction. That's odd, isn't it?
Get a GPS? Come on.
It's odd. And there's this whole branch of scientific research, biomimicry, where they're looking at nature and asking, you know, how did species solve this particular problem? And they've come up with all kinds of things, like placement of wind turbines in configuration similar to bird flocks flying together, you know, flying, rather than in a grid. Anyway, it seems to me that part of the new paradigm might be respecting the natural world as this experiment that has occurred over eons and is like an encyclopedia of information and should be protected for that, as well as, you know, all ecosystems are made up of all these balances between beings, and if we destroy that, then, you know, we hurt our own chance for survival since we're dependent on ecosystems. And so on. Here's one that comes from TV, Stephen Colbert interviewing a guy who put educational videos on YouTube. The man who's been posting popular educational lessons free on YouTube told Colbert he makes them the length of students' concentration, 10 minutes. How many complex sentences is 10 minutes? What number of chapters is in a minute? If you use tiny type, you can see more at once. If you surf the photographs, you can piece all you need together of the news. What great grandparents called an hour now happens in a few shakes of a lamb's tail. The lifetime of your equipment may be less than what you need, but it's so much more beyond thought where we are now. within the vast reaches of unending convergence. And here are our futures and quantum computers, the serious explanations of how they'll work, which have given the brain an idea, building one of them into itself. It already has everything it needs. The idea is more than enough. Now 10 minutes are an outmoded remnant of a quaint era when people sat in steel propelled by explosions in order to arrive in time. Now, everyone's there already. You don't need to listen. You already know. A couple more. This one's called The Idea of a Little Water. And it begins, say in a high-rise conference room. Water in a glass shouldn't be leaving behind a great deal of damage. Half gone in a few moments as the galaxy bends, small water like this won't be head high and imperative transactions or browbeating the semblance of wisdom out of its folds, bound to the week of work but lacking skin. Water's always being let go. Its surface is so light gravity can't hold it down. Suddenly water's feathering into its molecular wing, flying light into eyes. The eye of the frog drips with anticipation in the half-lit evening marine. Cooling falls and more water's gone parachuting over the county line in the circulation between private identities. The first matter missed when thirst would rather survive. Water struggles at each corner to break loose from the current trouble it's seeing. Working the surface in its cloud of satellites, ascending in elaborate tiny chandeliers that shatter out of history, water has seen everything a body can dish out and has already gone more places than still exist. But then the nature of water is to join the wave, to concentrate so fully it symbolizes nothing but bulk. With its tendency to think nothing about moving the salt sea further inland, plowing off with any 10-ton truck in the way. In raging wind, water will be flying shrapnel or avalanching with all its weight into reactors, prying apart what anyone may have nailed down. It drops off Japanese docks on the Oregon coast in front of the brain. Before enough time exists for most to comprehend, and one more, where night and the day coexist. The first speech of people must have been felt. The whole body, speaking through the whole body. Lengthy planetary winds have been working outside camera snaps of bald Celsius drying in light where adaptations have reached for hungers of creation, approaching the pulse point in blue roaring unknowns. Anyone who pursues this life can be struck dumb by salt slept axling or the onion shock peels of clock face draw as evening carries on. Dull ringing of clogged bronze bells of the ancestors moves through clay of the body at the root of fluid cells. Mineral shimmering sweeps over afternoon as if could we have forgotten cells that made us the way we were born? Is this the planet where Henry V learns to stop being a warrior, where ancestors wanted us to live, and the whole body looks through the eyes? Dark long hair of the mother in Genesis appears to the impossible to count cells. Everything has a share of what we may have forgotten.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for coming out on this sultry night and for your attention and respect to these poets and their craft. And thank you to Dan Raphael for organizing this, and also to Matt Schumacher and James Graybill. And we do this, we do this almost every week. We also have an open mic that does happen every week at 8 o'clock. And so Mary Slocum is our lovely hostess for tonight, and she's going to put out the, over at the Cream and Sugar, she's going to put up the sign-up list. In about 15 minutes, we'll get started. Thank you.